court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity.
I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Staying warm out here today, Tommy?
Yeah, warm enough, I guess. 6 inches of snow up on Three Last Mountains. A little rough going.
Yeah, we did get some snow. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Man, he's nipping at things other than my nose. Some things you don't want to get nipped.
or snipped, for that matter. I kind of liked it because in a rare move, the court system was actually closed today, too. I was supposed to have two hearings today, and they were both canceled because of the inclement weather. And it was very nice because I'd written an appeal and got it filed this week, and I already worked about 30 hours between Monday and Tuesday. So
you needed a break.
It was very nice.
Yeah, we got that 6 inches of snow blew in here, and really our local traffic cleanup didn't do too good. And then it dropped to zero last night, so we went ahead and closed our business. We told everybody yesterday, don't come in. Don't come in today. It's not going to be worth it. So we just shut her down.
I was practicing law today, briefly at my office, but that was just a briefly practicing law at my office.
I wasn't. I was practicing watching Charlie.
There you go. Well, this episode is actually not about the weather. What we're going to be talking about today is a practice called swatting.
Not flies, huh?
Not flies. And this was actually suggested on the court-appointed Facebook page by Joseph Atwell. Thank you, Joseph. And maybe you go by Joe. Thanks, Joe. Hey, Joe. Thanks.
Hey, Joe. That was an old song by Jimi Hendrix.
It was.
Hey, Joe.
I don't think he shot his woman down.
Where are you going with that gun in your hand?
Well, maybe he's going swatting. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. But maybe they better call the swatters on him. That was an appropriate name for that. Maybe that's why he did that. Maybe he's the Joe that Jimmy was talking about.
But the article that he linked to was actually where a man from California by the name of Tyler Barris was charged with involuntary manslaughter in Kansas over a swatting incident. So before we get into the article and talk about swatting, in general, I thought it'd be good to kind of define what swatting is, so we know what we're talking about.
Well, swatting is basically a serious prank. I mean, to call it a prank to me is much too, there needs to be a heavier term.
Yeah.
Because a prank is when you throw an egg at somebody's car, or a prank is, you know, setting a bag of manure on fire on the front porch and ringing the doorbell so that somebody opens up the door and stomps it out. That's a prank.
Yeah, those are definitely under the guise of pranks.
You know, but doing this, you're just risking people's lives. You call 911 and you give a location and you say there are people that have been killed. There are people being held hostage. You know, I'm going to kill the next person that comes to the door. You know, whatever. You set up a really serious situation.
Right. And that's because they want a certain amount of force to come out to investigate this.
Right. They don't want just a domestic disturbance where somebody comes up and knocks on the door and says, is there a problem here?
Yeah.
They want them to come with the full mobile military artillery and
the SWAT team
knocking down doors, just like at the end of Christmas Vacation when they come swinging in through the windows and everything else.
They want them to come with the SWAT team.
Hard and heavy.
Which stands for Special Weapons and Tactics, and that police departments usually have those. And they will bust down doors and come in with full force. So they actually make these calls with different kinds of complaints or whatever that would elicit that kind of response from a police department or other emergency response departments. Or I've lost my train of thought, something.
Yeah, the main reason, though, that I say this is a whole lot more serious than just a prank is the officers that are in these SWAT teams, they're not called out except in extraordinary circumstances, life and death circumstances, hostage situations, shootouts,
bank robberies. Like that.
Yeah, I mean, serious things. They're not called out because your cat's stuck in a tree or something like that. When these guys roll, they're locked and loaded.
Yeah.
They are ready to, they're going into, in their mind, it's a life and death situation, and they would rather come out of it with their life and your death, if you're the bad guy, I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, and they're setting up people, I mean, they're setting up these situations for somebody to get killed. And the only thing that amazes me is that there aren't more people that have been seriously hurt or killed from these events.
Yeah, and this is, comparing it to a prank, I think you're right, is not really... It's not really like a prank. It's more like a bomb threat or something along those lines. Where somebody could actually, that's actually probably even worse than a bomb threat because there's actually
in a bomb threat usually have at least a civil evacuation and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, if you did something that caused stampeding towards the doors of a crowded theater or a concert or something like that, so that people were stomping on each other and crushing them into doorways and things like that, that's about what it's like.
Well, it's not a new term. It's actually was first used by the FBI back in about 2008. And was actually added to the dictionary in 2015. And I remember hearing about it. It's been some years ago, and I remember because there's videos on YouTube where you can actually see, because one of the people that have been swatted before are celebrities and live streamers.
Yeah, those seem to be the two that are the usual targets. The live streamers, it's because they can see what their prank, and I use that term loosely, but they see what their prank creates.
Yeah.
Because the guy's there got the, you know, he's either on the box or he's YouTubing it or something like that so that they can play that back, or because people are watching and then here comes the cops going in. And I've watched a couple of those. And I mean, you see the guy there and he's with his game controller and he's watching. And he goes, wait a minute, what's that I hear? Oh my God, I think I'm being swatted. I think I'm being swatted, and bam, here they come through the door. They grab him, throwing him on the floor. He got their boot across the back of his neck, yelling at him, hands behind your back, hands behind your back, stay down on the floor. I mean, that's a serious situation because these, like I say, these cops come in and they're coming in ready to kill somebody because they think it's a life and death situation.
Well, they have loaded guns, which are pointed at people.
Yeah.
Anytime there's a loaded gun pointed at somebody, that's a scary situation.
And it could go off.
Yeah, very easily.
And on the other hand, you're not doing anything wrong. You're in your house and it's the middle of the night. Somebody comes busting in your house. If you're the type of person that has armed yourself to protect yourself, depending on, you know, where you live and what the laws are, and you're within your rights to have a gun, you hear somebody busting in your house, your first instinct might be to grab your gun.
Yeah, because you think it's a bad guy coming in.
Yeah, and then boom, next thing you know, you're in a face-off with a policeman and you're dead. And when you wake up dead, you're really going to be upset.
It's not a good way to wake up.
No, nobody wants to wake up dead.
Now, who are some of the celebrities that have been swatted in the past?
Well, there's a whole string of them. When they started off calling, the list goes back. This is from about 2012. Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus, Rihanna, Chris Brown, Tom Cruise, Clint Eastwood. Man, you don't mess with Clint Eastwood.
No, that's wrong. You gotta stay off his lawn.
That's right. He will get you. Simon Cowell, Ryan Seacrest, the Kardashians, they've had several. Paris Hilton, Ashton Kutcher, Selena Gomez, Magic Johnson, Sean Puff Diddy Combs, or whatever he's calling himself this week. I know that changes a lot. But they've all been swatted at different times. And in the case of the one Ashton Kutcher and Justin Bieber, that was a 12-year-old that had done it. They arrested a 12-year-old boy in connection. Now, what are you going to do to a 12-year-old boy that would have done something like that?
Yeah. There have been, like I said, there's a lot of, on YouTube videos, you can see where these people were streaming on like Twitch and things like that, playing CSGO and different kinds of games, Halo, Destiny, Call of Duty. And usually it's these multiplayer games. And I guess, ironically, it's usually some sort of shooter game when the police kick in their door. I don't know if that's really a proper use of the word irony, but because it's really...
Right. And you know, it's a good thing that they're using controllers in their hands and not like fake guns or something.
They're playing duck hunt?
Yeah, like in duck hunt, you had that rifle that you used.
If you swatted somebody who was actually live streaming playing duck hunt on Twitch, that would be really bad.
Yeah, because the cops come in and they're sitting there with rifles, and they may be toy rifles, but it'd be like that other video that somebody posted on the Facebook site when the kids, the two teenagers, were robbing like the 7-Eleven with a fake gun.
Yeah.
And this armed security guard comes running out of the back and they're saying, "Our gun's fake, our gun's fake." And he says, "Yeah, mine's real." Yeah. You don't want to be in that situation.
Well, I want to get back and talk about this case that was posted on the page, because there's actually some interesting things in there that are going to lead to some other legal issues that are probably going to come up at the trial. But before that, I believe we have some court costs or maybe some pending motions.
A pending motion, if you will, sir. We'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs. Don't jump on my part of the bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean to step on your toes.
Yes, Your Honor, today we would like to present a brand new sponsor to Court Appointed.
All right, who's our brand new sponsor?
Well, we are proud to have Pitney Bowes.
Pitney Bowes, our brand new sponsor. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for sponsoring us.
Pitney Bowes is the industry leader in mailing and shipping solutions. No matter what you send or how often, Pitney Bowes has a solution that precisely fits your needs.
Weigh, print, mail, and save. You and your business will save time and money when you print postage, and you won't need to wait in line at the post office anymore. I know that's one thing I always dread, being a lawyer, having to go to the post office, having to mail out things, because you have to make sure when you're practicing law that people get proper notice. And that's one of the things that is often comes up in court cases. Did you send out a letter to them? Do they have notices? You know, all those kinds of things. So I end up going to the post office quite a bit for mailings.
Well, in our business, we're mail out invoices and bills and things like that. And you've got to go buy books of stamps and stand in line to get that. And, you know, the post offices are never properly manned.
No, it seems like they used to be more when I was growing up, but now it seems like there's
one person.
Yeah,
they have lines out the door.
They have five different like little stations there, and there's one person working them all. I mean, it's very inefficient.
And he is in no hurry to get anything done.
No,
because he's there for his 8 hours, and when they're up, he's going home.
That's
so
right.
So he's just there, however, whatever it takes. And then on top of that, they're doing passports as well. So every once in a while, you don't have anybody available because they're back doing the passports.
Well, now, Pitney Bowes does not do passports. I don't think that's on their list of things they do.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. I was just talking about things that delay you at the post office.
But they do just about everything else. They will even put the correct amount of postage on your letter or package.
Now, as most of you may have been aware, that on January 21st, USPS mailing and shipping costs rose up. So now you'll save 3 cents per letter with Pitney Bowes' solution. And these discounts are not available at the post office.
That's right. With Pitney Bowes, you can beat the increase. Whether you're sending a letter or package, you'll be paying less and saving money if you're using a Pitney Bowes sending solution.
Now, here's what we want you to do. They have plans that start at just $5 per month. And for our listeners, Pitney Bowes is offering a free trial, so you're sure to find the solution that's right for you.
Visit pb.com/court to learn more and try it for free. Terms apply. See site for details.
That's pb.com/court. And we thank Pitney Bowes very much for becoming a new sponsor of our podcast.
And just remember, when you support our sponsors, you help make this podcast possible. All right. Now, the swatting incident that was mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, when we were talking about it, the one in Kansas. So what's interesting about that, and there's a jurisdictional issue too, and that might be why some of these cases are kind of hard to prove from time to time. The person who actually is alleged to have called in the swatting incident is in California. And the person who was swatted was in Kansas, Wichita, Kansas. So in this particular case, there was a phone call from California, which was made after a small wager online while playing Call of Duty. Now, the article didn't say which Call of Duty it was, which I find, as a gamer, I find a very important piece of information, but I'm assuming it was Call of Duty World War II, which is the new one, which is currently getting a lot of gameplay at my house right now. So,
so your call is going to be coming your way next.
No, I don't stream. No one would even know.
Oh.
So anyway, the prosecutors alleged that this Tyler Barris, who was in Los Angeles when he called the police on December 28th with the story about a shooting and kidnapping at a home in Wichita, Kansas. And the caller who phoned Wichita police said in a relatively calm voice that he had shot his father in the head and was holding his mother and a sibling at gunpoint. And that's according to the 911 recording. He said he poured gasoline inside the home and he might just set it on fire. So by doing this, he was kind of already setting up this incident. He'd already killed one person. There's other people there he might kill. And, you know, he's also doused in gasoline and it might just light it. So he's
making it as volatile a situation as he can create.
Yes. Now, when the police arrived, they unfortunately shot 28-year-old Andrew Finch after he opened his door. They said he moved his hand towards his waistband and an officer, fearing that he was reaching for a gun, fired a single shot and killed him. And he was unarmed at the time. So here's the bad thing. Is that Finch's family said he did not even play video games and wasn't the intended target of the prank known, as we talked about, as swatting. And that somebody basically, well, I mean, it's never correct or proper, but somebody basically sent the police to the wrong house. So
So that wasn't, they were trying to get somebody that was an online gamer and they got the wrong address.
Exactly.
Is what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. And obviously the parents of the victim said that they think that the police murdered their son. So,
well, sure.
But, you know, I mean, obviously, anytime you have a situation like that, there's going to be some sort of issues about whether the police took proper precautions. You know, was the guy really moving his hand towards the waistband? Obviously, he was unarmed. But, you know, this whole situation was set up by this heightened sense of urgency by the police. You know, it was already
because
killed.
Of the details they were given.
Exactly.
And like I say, these squads do not roll into jaywalking incidents.
Yeah.
They roll into life and death situations, and they're coming expecting that. So their view of their perspective is going to be tainted by that thought of what's going on.
And here's the thing, too, is that they didn't actually even knock on the door. He had heard something outside, so he opened the door to see what was going on. And that's when the police, they shot him. So, you know, I think it was kind of a perfect storm and really just a nightmare, you know, I mean, that of the way it worked out.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of these celebrity ones, when I read about it, I don't think there was any one of them that was at home. Everyone that I read about, they weren't the person that they were trying to get, I guess, wasn't even at the house at the time that it happened, as far as the celebrity ones go.
Yeah.
So apparently celebrities don't spend a lot of time at their own house. So.
No.
But so that may be why nothing too terrible happened. But the police have got to start finding better ways to maybe, you know, like if this call came in from California and it supposedly was happening in Kansas and I'm in the house and I've done this, why am I calling from California?
Yeah. Well, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll spoof different numbers that appear local. And there's ways to do that with different things on the internet.
If they did that.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure this guy probably did it. And here's why. Here's what's interesting. It's going to lead to the legal discussion we have. This guy, Tyler Bears, he has a history of making these hoax phone calls. He had actually built somewhat of a reputation online for helping others gain revenge on rival players. So he made fake bomb threats and other hoaxes and basically had been in jail for a hoax like this before. So it's not the first time it had happened. He actually said in one call, he called a Los Angeles elementary school and said there are 10 backpacks that have bombs in them. And so the school was evacuated. And he also said in the recording, do not take this lightly.
Well, so he got caught for that?
He did.
And he didn't go to jail for very long?
He did go to jail.
For how long, though?
I think it was about a year.
Well, obviously, it wasn't long enough. He didn't learn his lesson, but it needed to be, first of all, it needs to be more severe, and second of all, it needs to be very progressive. I know that we had a case here just recently that I saw on the news where a lady had been arrested for making false 911 calls, and she'd done about 60 calls.
Yeah, I think when people do this kind of thing, it's almost like a disease, or not a disease, but like it's something they do repetitively. It's like a...
Yeah, it's like a... What's that? Munchausen by proxy?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, but with calling 911, where you can't help yourself but hurt your own kid because you like them being in the hospital and the attention you receive or something. I think there's something to do with an attention factor. There's something wrong with somebody that does this, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, allegedly, he's using his grandmother's phone and computer, he's called in at least 24 different fake bomb threats and other prank emergencies in recent years. He targeted a television station in Glendale, and sometimes even targeting venues in Illinois and New Hampshire. And here's the thing. In 2015, basically, according to one police officer in California said, he embarked on a course of conduct that terrorized citizens in Los Angeles County. He made calls that prompted evacuations of television stations, two schools, and he knows exactly what to say. He's very meticulous. And he knows what a 911 operator will ask and is very convincing when he says it. So basically, he pleaded no contest to a bomb threat charge in May of 2016 and was sentenced to 2 years and 8 months in jail. He was subsequently released on January 20th, 2017, but then basically was arrested again for some sort of domestic violence type issue with his grandmother. So basically, he was actually just got out of jail fairly recently for something very similar to this.
That's so unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, here's where we're going to get into some legal stuff. Now, when he is tried in Kansas, and he's being charged with involuntary manslaughter in Kansas for making this false phone call. And the reason, you know, I think that basically the making these false statements is not a serious crime, but when somebody dies, involuntary manslaughter, that's a pretty serious charge.
I think they should get him for murder, too.
Well, you know, depends on what the Kansas statutes look like, what they can charge him with. So,
yeah.
But now here, let me ask you a question. When they try him for this crime, for the involuntary manslaughter in Kansas, do you think they should be allowed to introduce his previous crimes of making these false phone calls?
Well, here's what I think. Unless you were trying to build a case that this guy is a serial caller doing these things, I don't think it's relevant. I think that it doesn't matter. The result was he did this, he did it as a prank, and somebody died from it, and he needs to pay for it. The other ones don't matter, I don't think.
Well, prior crimes and things like that are governed by what's called 404B evidence.
404B.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the, well, it's in the federal rules of evidence is 404B, and it's also in West Virginia, it calls it 404B2. Now, in different states, they might call it different things, but our rules of evidence track along with the federal numbers. So some states do that, some don't. So basically it reads that evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts is not admissible to prove the character of a person in order to show action in conformity therewith. It may, however, be admissible for other purposes, such as proof of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of a mistake or accident, provided that upon request of the accused by the accused, the prosecution in a criminal case shall provide reasonable notice in advance of trial or during trial if the court excuses pretrial notice on good cause shown of the general nature of any such evidence it intends to introduce at trial. So basically what they're saying is that in order to introduce these prior acts, it has to meet the certain criteria of why you're introducing it. Because the problem with it is that it tends to sway a jury one way without actually determining whether a person committed that crime in particular.
Right. And that's what I say. I don't think in this case that it matters. Now, if there was a progressive discipline, like for one call, you go this long. For two calls, you get caught, you go this many years. And for three calls, then the other ones, the prior ones, are relevant.
Right. Well, generally, when you have situations like that, you have what's called bifurcation of trials, because those second offense, third offense, fourth offense things are generally sentencing guidelines and not necessarily crimes themselves. And that tends to also polarize a jury if they say, well, this is the second time he's done it, because again, you're getting into the fact that it's prejudicing the jury by saying this.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, he did it. So that's what you're trying to establish, is that he did it. Then later you decide, what does he deserve to pay for it?
Exactly.
And so it doesn't matter that he did all those other crimes, because whether he did or didn't do those other crimes, if this was the first time he did it, he's still responsible for this guy dying.
Exactly. One example I found on the internet was this. So if Bill Cosby is on trial for sexually assaulting Andrea Constand in Philadelphia in 2004, the prosecutor cannot call Beth Ferrier as a witness to testify that Cosby gave her drugs and sexually assaulted her in 1986. Nor can the prosecutor call 50 women to testify that Cosby drugged and assaulted them. The only reason it would be relevant is to prove that he had a pattern of criminal behavior, which is also known as character evidence. So basically, the prosecutor has to come up with some sort of relevant reason why the jury should hear about Cosby's past acts. It must be a genuine disputed issue of real consequence, or 403, the rule of evidence 403 will exclude it. So the presidential effect is obvious. The whole world has made up its mind that Cosby is guilty based on solely of the number of claims. So if you pile on all these claims, then basically your mind's made up as to what's going on. And the jury will as well if they hear about them. So basically the prejudicial effect of hearing about these will substantially outweigh the probative value unless there's a genuine issue that needs to be presented. So,
well, the only reason I disagree with that, though, is then you get into that he said, she said. Because she said, well, he gave me a drink that drugged me, and I woke up, and this is what was taking place.
Right.
He says, it was all consensual. I didn't do anything. I don't know what you're talking about. Now, if that's the only case that you've got, then you're kind of at a impasse maybe as to who do you want to believe. But if you've got 50 women saying the same thing, they all have the same story, and his answer is, oh, it was all consensual.
Right.
Now there's, you know, there's a little bit, not a little bit, there's a lot more to that story.
Right.
So I would say you need to let it in.
Now, it might come in if it shows a very specific criminal pattern. Like if he always took them to a certain restaurant and always like
gave them a certain drink and they had a certain reaction, physical reaction from it and stuff like that.
And see, that actually has probative value.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
And when I say probative, what I'm saying, and this is a definition of probative, it's evidence which is sufficiently useful to prove something important in a trial. Probative value of proposed evidence must be weighed by the trial judge against prejudicing the minds of the jurors towards the opposing party or criminal defendant. So that's the balancing test. Probative value versus prejudicial effect. So,
well, I mean, it would be like if somebody was accused of domestic violence and he says, well, I've never hit anybody in my life. And then you have three people that can come in and say, well, yeah, I filed charges against him where he hit me. I mean, those are things that should be heard, you know, because he has a history of violence. He can't sit there and say you don't have a history of it when you do.
Well, now, there's a difference thing. If he comes out and says that I don't have a history of violence, then that opens the door. Then you can bring all the stuff in, and that's something kind of different. Because at that point, you're putting the character and you're putting his propensity for violence at issue. So then basically the state can rebut that.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Good.
But to bring it in their case in chief, you can't do that if you move to exclude it and it doesn't have any probative value.
We're going
to
rebut that.
Exactly. And I actually had a very recent case where that came into play, and I'll talk about that here towards the end. And if you remind me about that whole character evidence thing.
I'll remind you about the rebutton.
The rebutton? If the prosecutor convinces the judge that the evidence is genuinely relevant to prove something like intent, it doesn't necessarily make it admissible. It just basically removes the evidence from an automatic exclusion as character evidence under 404 because it is relevant for a purpose other than to show criminal tendencies. So basically, at that point, becomes more intertwined with this rule 403 of evidence. So what you have at play here is you have to look at, and the 403 does go to the probative value versus prejudicial effect. So you have this character evidence under 404B and prior crimes under 404B. So you have to get through that initial threshold. And then you have to get to 403 and say, hey, is it worth bringing in or is it going to prejudice the jury?
Well, it depends on if you're just trying to prove the guy's a criminal, then you're barking up the wrong tree. If you're trying to prove certain aspects of how he committed this specific crime, then you're probably on the right course.
That's right. Evidence that a defendant has committed some crime other than the one they're being tried for obviously has a very prejudicial effect against jurors. It makes the jurors become very emotional about this. They feel like that the person's, you know, is a criminal, and it basically kind of confuses the issues, and it really doesn't have a lot of probative value. It doesn't show much. It doesn't show any evidence really that the person committed this crime, unless there's some sort of reason, like we had mentioned before. And there's been some empirical studies done that show jurors are willing to give an accused person the benefit of the presumption of innocence only if it's their first offense. So, basically, you have a constitutional right to be presumed innocent. Well, by introducing these prior crimes, you're almost taking that away based on studies from what juries show. So,
well, all right, but let's say that this particular guy, as you said, he had a history of doing this several other times and had been to prison for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if he came up and he said, hey, look, I didn't do this. I plead not guilty because I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't me.
Right.
Why could you not say, well, look, not only do we think it's him because of this evidence, but he has a history of it?
Well, no, you can't do that. If that's all he says is basically, even better, if he doesn't take the stand at all, he doesn't even testify, which he has the right not to do.
But he pleaded not guilty, which is saying I didn't do it.
But still, the state has to prove their case against him, and he never has to take the stand.
Well, I know he doesn't have to. Usually, if they don't have to, that means they're guilty.
No, it can't be held against them.
I know. You went through that. You read that before as to why. That's one of the prime rules of court. But
yeah,
that you may say that in court, but that doesn't mean that it's true.
The accused should basically only be tried on the evidence they committed the crime on that date, not just pile on other things. And the presumption of innocence should not only be like, you know, if they testify or things like that. It's got to be, it's absolute. So.
Well, I can tell you this, if I was an innocent man, I would get up there and proclaim it.
No, you might not want to.
Why not? If you're innocent, you have nothing to hide.
No, that's the wrong, 100% wrong attitude. It's up to the prosecutor to prove their case. If you don't think the prosecutor's proved their case, and there's nothing good that can come from you testifying, there's no reason you should testify. No reason you should do that. Because basically, you're only going to help their case and open yourself up to cross-examination where they might trip you up.
They can't trip up the truth.
So recently, I had a trial where a guy was charged with possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance.
Is this the rebut thing I was supposed to remind you?
It is.
Okay, so I don't have to remind you now?
Yep.
Okay.
He let them search his cell phone after he was arrested, and they found tons of text messages regarding him kind of talking about selling drugs in these text messages.
Kind of talking about it?
Well, I mean, they were a little bit vague, but it's kind of easy to read between the lines as to what they were talking about.
I've got 3 ounces of product. Do you want it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not really vague.
Hey, 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 smoke weed every day, eh? So, yeah, stuff like that. So, but none of these texts had really anything to do, well, actually had nothing to do with the night he was arrested or the crime he was being charged for. And none of them were between the guy who is alleged to have going and this intent to sell these drugs to. And so basically I moved to exclude the evidence. I filed what's called a motion in limine. And that's what you file to exclude evidence.
A motion in limine?
Mm-hmm.
Like limine stickets?
Lemony stickets, yeah. And the court excluded it. And so basically the prosecutor could not use that cell phone text message as any kind of evidence to prove its case in chief.
So you're saying that because he texted with other people about drugs, he didn't text with this guy about drugs. So why is that relevant to this other guy, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And there was no allegation that he was texting with the guy to sell him drugs or anything like that. So, I mean, I think basically, if he had been texting with this guy to sell drugs, then you could say, well, this is how he sells drugs. He uses text messaging to do it. Then at least you'd have an argument to stand on as to why it has some sort of probative value. Otherwise, it's just prejudicial. It's like, well, see, he's a drug dealer, you know, whatever. Now, in that case, I talked to my client and we came to the conclusion that we didn't want him to testify. We wanted the state to have to prove their case. And the part of the reason was is that we did not want to open the door for them to bring in these text messages because it would have been very easy for him to be up on the stand and for basically the prosecutor to kind of lure him into some sort of conversation where he says, I don't sell drugs. I'm not a drug dealer. I didn't do this. And the second he does that, all these text messages
come in. Can you explain these text messages that you sent on such date?
Yeah. And so basically all the work we had done to try to get those things excluded would have been for naught because it'd be coming in now because he opened it up for character evidence. And that's different because you can always use these things for character evidence to rebut somebody's good character. If somebody puts their character in question by saying they have good character, then you can bring in all this other stuff and open the door to show that they don't have good character.
So as soon as he said that, you would have heard some dramatic music play, and then the prosecutor would stand up and say, Your Honor, I move to bring in this evidence.
No, if you had heard that testimony come out and then you heard the prosecutor ask that question, you would have heard me go, are you we tried to blah 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 you idiot.
Wow, my ears are burning after all that.
that's why I could not put my client on stand.
Is that proper courtroom language to use? What's the decorum process for that?
No, but that would have been one of those things. It's like, no.
Your Honor, I ask that his tongue be disbarred.
So, but yeah, there's a lot of strategy that goes into things like that. And that was kind of the reason why you might not take the stand.
Well, okay. But there again, the guy was guilty. So that's why he didn't take the stand.
No, he was actually found not guilty.
Well, he might have been found that way, but that doesn't mean he was.
Let me tell you something. Every now and then you actually have an innocent client. I really believe he was innocent of that crime on that night.
I like the way that's worded, that crime on that night. Now, if it had been the day before or the day after, they had him. But that particular night, he was in a gray area.
Well, and I think that's part of the reason why, I think that's part of the reason why they were hot and heavy to prosecute him. Because they saw this evidence where he had kind of been doing some of this stuff maybe before, and they didn't catch him. And then they almost caught him on this, but they didn't want to let him go because they had evidence that he, you know, mm-hmm. have been doing this kind of behavior. So, but it wasn't a very strong case. So, I mean, the prosecutor and I talked about it beforehand too. I mean, the prosecutor knew it wasn't that strong of a case. We basically figured it was going to be a coin toss depending on what the jury decided they wanted to do. So,
The problem is around here right now that you can't swing a dead cat around without either hitting a drug dealer or an addict. I mean, if you line up three guys, one of them's the addict, one of them's a drug dealer, and one of them's innocent of these things. So,
yeah,
you know, you got a 66% chance of catching somebody that's been doing something they shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah, and a lot of times, some of these cases that people are getting caught around here, I don't really think they're drug dealers per se. They're people who are addicts and users. And,
that are selling drugs to support their own habit.
Yeah, but they're not really selling much. They're just moving small amounts back and forth. It's kind of like a exchange barter system almost. So,
well, I understand what you're saying, but they're still breaking the law, and they are also dragging more people into the abyss of addiction.
I would not argue with that one bit. So, but yeah, we kind of got off of swatting a little bit because it led into that evidentiary issue, but I thought that'd be kind of a good thing to talk about. So,
well, that kind of goes hand in hand with the information pursuant to this case.
That was very scholarly. If nothing else that comes to this podcast, you've learned how to use the word pursuant in a sentence. And we hope you have too.
I ran that red light and them cops was pursuing me.
I hit a tree, or I was driving my car. When the cops were pursuing me, I hit a tree and went probative into that tree or something. I don't know. It sounded better in my head. It was between my ears and not out my mouth yet. So, what do you understand the whole issue with the 404B, the 403, and the probative value, the prejudicial effect, and all that?
I believe so.
All right.
And if you're guilty, keep your mouth shut.
That's right. 100%.
Yeah. Make them prove it.
Well, since you seem to have a grasp on this, let's go to
Legal Brief.
This is the first time listening. Legal Brief is a part of the show where I ask Tommy questions about the different legal issues and theories presented to him, and we see if he can remember it. So.
Well, sure I can. Pursuant to the question thereof within, therefore.
I don't know how your sentence was germane to this part of the show.
It wasn't germane. It was French.
Okay. What is probative value?
Probative value means probative is like you're probing something. And so it's probative value means you're probing at something of that it is pertinent to the case. So you're asking something that has information relevant to the case at hand.
The last little bit you said, yes. The first part where you're stammering around a little bit, no.
You know, it's got no probing involved?
No, there's no probing. It means
if
more
you're like, an alien, there probably is. You notice there's always probing when there's an alien.
Yeah, I don't know why.
They have long fingers, too.
I hear they're very cold as well. So, the probative value, yes, is something that is useful to prove something that is important at trial. Now, what is probative value weighed against?
Hearsay or stuff that you'd say that doesn't really matter. It just shows character stuff.
No, it's weighed against prejudicial effect.
Oh, prejudicial effect.
Yeah. So probative value versus prejudicial effect whenever you're looking at this kind of evidence, because you want to determine whether or not what good it has and whether or not it's going to prejudice the jury or inflame them. So,
okay.
Like piling on about all these different crimes where the person may have committed a bunch of different criminal acts in the past that are kind of different than the crime that the person did, that would have no probative value and be very prejudicial. Something okay. Where it shows like a common scheme where the person always commits a crime a certain way and has been convicted of it in the past, that has some that has some probative value, even though it's somewhat prejudicial. So it might come in.
All right. I got it. So too much probing can cause inflammation.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. What federal and West Virginia rule of evidence governs prior crimes? It's a number.
404B.
That's right. 404B.
There you go.
Nailed it.
404B. And it's and the one other one that goes along with it is 403.
That's right. What is a motion in limine?
A motion in limine. That's a motion in limine snickets. A motion in limine. You said that, and I made the limine snickets, and I sat back and was so proud of myself. I don't think I listened to the answer.
A motion in limine is essentially a motion that a defense attorney would file, or it could be in a civil case as well, where basically you want to exclude some sort of evidence. The main reason why you want to exclude it usually is because you argue it has no probative value or
pressure. You did with the cell phone.
Exactly.
With the cell phone records that you said it wasn't relevant to what was going on in that case.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that guy wasn't involved.
So, final question.
Dun, dun, dun.
Should prior crimes come in?
Yes and no. It depends on their probative value.
That's a good answer. You're talking like a lawyer.
Well, pursuant to this pursuant to this episode, then I have prolonged my legal knowledge.
Okay, now you're making my head hurt.
Well, talk about making your head hurt. It hurt my head to see when we were corrected on the Facebook page. I was talking last week about the Stock Act and how that also dictated that Congress could not act on any knowledge that they had and profit from insider trading. And we talked about how that came about in 2012. Well, my research didn't turn up, and Kathy Park wrote in to let us know on the Facebook page, that in 2013, Congress quietly went in and removed most of the language from that. Now, they didn't do away with it completely, but they removed most of the language from that so that so that it's not quite so easy to find. There's no database that any of the information resides in. If you want to see if anybody in Congress took advantage of any of these things, you have to go in and look under one particular person and look at their practices all the way through. I mean, you know, day by day as it went through, but there's not like a database you could go in and cross-reference.
Now, if you were an enterprising computer entrepreneur, you could go ahead and find some sort of program that scrapes all that and compiles it and be a real thorn in their side.
But you can't get it from the outside world. You have to go to this basement office in the Capitol complex and go down there, and you have to use their system to do it.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah, and that's why they have it. Now, one of the things they said was it was because they didn't – it was to guard against, like, ID theft and stuff like that, that people would be able to gain too much personal information from our Congress people.
That sounds like a really well-thought-up argument after about a year of figuring out, how can we get around this and get out of this?
Exactly.
I got it. But identity theft.
You know, the greed, it's not just in the corporate, but most of these guys, they're corporate people.
That's true.
You have to have greed to be in the position they're in for the most part.
Now, if you didn't listen to the last week's episode, first of all, you should. Second of all.
Do us a favor and do it.
Stock stands for Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge. And that was one of the things we talked about last episode.
So. Yeah, that was one of those good acronyms. And it was a good idea. And apparently, one of the main reasons they did it is there was a big story on 60 Minutes, I think it was, that broke, that outlined all this stuff and embarrassed most of them. So they kind of said, look, we're going to put an end to this. We weren't really aware of this. Like, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So, you know, you talk about probative value. Yeah. Probative value of how many weren't aware of that. You know, they all are on different committees and have subject information. They got lobbyists coming in and telling them stuff and everything else. But anyway, so they gutted that, so they're probably back to trading. It's insider trading is still forbidden for them.
Yeah.
But proving it is a completely different thing. I still think...
Well, insider trading is hard to prove generally because you have to show knowledge. And knowledge, what resides in somebody's mind, is always a hard thing to prove.
I still think the duck test is the way to go with that. That would do it. That would take care of everything. It, you know, all right, look, you were in a position of knowledge. You acted, you either sold or bought something prior to an event happening that was greatly in your favor as a result of that buy or sell.
Fortunately, the duck test is not actually a legal test. It's only a Tom Smurl test.
Well, it should be a legal test. By golly, when I'm elected, I'm going to install the duck test.
Well, speaking of installed, you're getting back up on your soapbox here again. We need to unbolt that, I think, maybe. I don't know.
No, leave it there. I'll use it for something else.
Well, thanks to Pitney Bowes for sponsoring our podcast.
Yep, appreciate it.
It's always great to have a new sponsor. And I want to thank everybody for listening, too.
If you have any questions or anything you'd like to see, any topics you want us to go over, don't hesitate to write in on the Facebook page or email us
Yeah.
We haven't gotten any emails in a long time.
We haven't. Maybe we should courtappointedpodcast@gmail.com. You can send us emails.
Yeah. Be glad to hear from you about whatever subject.
That's right. And if you haven't had a chance yet, you can always go on iTunes and write a glaring good review.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to write a bad one, don't waste your time.
That's right.
Right?
That's what we always say.
Yeah.
Or give us some stars on there.
Or preferably. We will as soon as you get a new ending edited.
That's right. I know. I got to edit that up.
Yep. Someone pointed out we should add a new ending. Well, we have. Michael just hadn't given it to me yet.
I'm going to move to strike that. I think your comment has no probative value.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.